Next up on This Week in Law, Lisa Ramsey joins me from the University of San Diego School of Law. We're going to talk about free speech and trademark and the intersection of the two. We'll discuss what Red Bull, Krispy Kreme, and Marriott get up to when Facebook goes down. We've got a vigilante county sheriff in the lineup. A couple of good laws protecting free speech and consumers working their way through the legislature. And collection of kids' data. All this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 329, recorded December 4th, 2015. Mind your toes. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by Braintree, looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit braintreepayments.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell here. You're joining us for This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us. I am sorry to report that my co-host Sarah Pearson is out this week. She will be back soon, but we have a great guest joining us here today. I'd like you to welcome to This Week in Law, Lisa Ramsey. Lisa's a professor at the University of San Diego School of Law. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Lisa specializes in the areas of international law, trademark law, intellectual property in general. So very much right in our wheelhouse for what we like to talk about here on the show. And we're going to get right into it. We're going to start with some trademark stories. Lisa, let's talk about Cuba. Since we are going to be opening up relations with a country that we've had no trade relations for decades, it's going to be an interesting situation there, isn't it? Both on the trademark and international law front and at the intersection of those two things.
That's correct. There's been some interesting, there's a news article recently about the fact that some companies in Cuba have been using the trademarks of a company such as McDonald's. And McDonald's recently went into this one company and let them know they should not use the word McDonald's in their trademark or the Golden Arches logo. And so the gentleman who was using these trademarks took them down. But a lot of companies like McDonald's have registered trademarks in Cuba, but because of the embargo, have not been doing business in Cuba. So now companies may consider actually setting up an actual McDonald's in there. They want to make sure that the unauthorized McDonald's restaurants are no longer operating.
So this isn't unique to Cuba. This kind of thing happens all over the world where someone will latch on to a well-known brand and perhaps attach it to their business. We have a good MSN Money article on the Cuba McDonald's situation specifically in our discussion points, which people can find and follow along with us and read after the show if you're so inclined at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. But what makes sort of the Cuba situation more unique and how might it differ from the way that companies approach misappropriation of a trademark in other countries?
Well, so first of all, I should probably explain that trademark rights are territorial, which means that you only have trademark rights in each nation where you have a registered trademark or you're actually using the trademark. For example, in the past, in South Africa during apartheid, certain companies, including McDonald's, were not actually doing business in South Africa, but people started using the McDonald's trademark there. And in that situation where you're not actually using the trademark, there are actually treaties that require countries to protect well-known trademarks. And so McDonald's was actually able to go into South Africa, argue that its mark was well-known to people in South Africa, and stop this particular individual from operating a McDonald's restaurant in South Africa. So, again, you can protect your trademark if you have a registration in that country, if you've been using the mark in that country, or if your trademarks are well-known in that country. Again, because of the embargo in Cuba, it's very similar, I think, to the situation in South Africa, where we didn't have businesses, U.S. businesses doing business in Cuba, and now they want to make sure that when they go into Cuba to do business, that they're the only one using their trademarks and not these other people who might be selling inferior products or services.
It was fascinating to me to read that, and again, this is from the MSN Money piece, that since 1966, there are over 1,500 U.S. businesses that have filed nearly 6,000 trademarks in Cuba, even though we have not had any sort of official trade relations with the country. Is that usual, that companies have that kind of foresight and proactive approach to protecting their trademarks?
Yes, compared to patents, which are actually quite expensive to obtain, a trademark registration is not that expensive. And one thing that you can do is file an application under the Madrid Protocol, which is a special international treaty that makes it very easy to file a trademark application, not just in your home country, but in other countries as well. And so what you do, for example, if you're in the United States, you're applying for your trademark registration, you can actually file a Madrid application and check the boxes of all the countries where you'd like to apply for a trademark. And then those countries can decide to refuse your application, for example, if they think that your mark is descriptive, without secondary meaning, or has other problems. But if they don't reject it, you can get automatic protection in those countries under the Madrid Protocol.
That's fascinating. It's not just U.S. companies that are going to be affected when we continue to expand trade relations with Cuba. There are plenty of large Cuban brands that are quite popular in the U.S. and elsewhere that get misappropriated, such as Cohiba Cigars and Havana Club Rum. How do you think U.S. Law enforcement will respond to infringement of those kinds of trademarks?
Well, so in the United States, again, we protect marks that are registered in the United States, marks that are used in the United States. And because a lot of these Cuban companies were not doing business in the United States, they were not able to assert trademark rights in the United States. So there's an example of the trademark Havana Club. The Puerto Rican manufacturer Bacardi was actually using the trademark Havana Club. And some people who had fled Cuba and gone to Puerto Rico originally had been involved with Havana Club in Cuba. And so they started selling Havana Club rum in the United States. And there was a dispute between the Cuban government version of it and a French company who was actually using Havana Club. And in the United States, the government and the courts decided that because of the embargo, that the Puerto Rican company had rights, superior rights, because we could not recognize any rights that the French, Cuban company had because of the embargo. Now, if because of the fact that Cuban companies might start doing business in America, they still are subject to the rights of other companies who currently have trademarks. Havana Club would still be owned by the Puerto Rican, Bacardi. But what it means is that these other businesses can actually come into the United States and use the mark and get rights that way. They can register their trademarks based on a registration in Cuba. And if the mark is well known in the United States, they can get protection in the United States. Also, there's a treaty, the Pan American Convention, of which the United States and a number of other Latin American countries are members, including Cuba. And Christine Haight Farley has written about this treaty. She calls it the Forgotten Treaty. And this treaty actually provides pretty strong protection to U.S. marks, but also to Cuban marks and marks people who in those other Latin American countries, such as Peru. If you, for example, come from Cuba, come to the United States, and somebody in the United States knows if you're a trademark, that a Cuban company can actually prevent you from registering or using the mark in the United States. So perhaps now that this Professor Farley's written about this treaty, it may no longer be forgotten. But this is another international agreement, or actually more of a regional agreement, that can affect these kinds of trademark disputes.
So sad you go to the trouble of entering into an international treaty and then it just gets forgotten. I think we'll make the Forgotten Treaty our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in the show for people who are submitting for continuing legal or other professional education credit and need to demonstrate that they've actually watched or listened to the show. For more information on that, you can go to wiki.twit.tv and find our This Week in Law page there. At least for lawyers, we've got the places where you might want to submit your application to receive credit for joining us here on the show. So the things we've been talking about concerning Cuba and trademarks, this is what I would think of as sort of traditional trademark framework where you have a mark, it's being used in business, it's not being used for satire or speech, but that happens as well too. And I know you've written and researched extensively in that area, Lisa, especially when it comes to how countries deal with each other on that point. Can you bring us up to speed as to what's going on now? I know you published on this earlier this year.
Sure. So trademarks consist of words, right? Colors, product designs. And when we're talking about trademarks consisting of words or even symbols, for example, people can use them in an expressive manner. So, for example, you can put words on the front of a T-shirt, or perhaps you might use a descriptive word that's protected as a trademark, but in a manner to describe your own products or services. And so what I've argued in my scholarship is that courts need to think a little bit more about First Amendment interests in trademark disputes, not just involving non-commercial speech, but also commercial speech. And courts actually have been taking more interest in freedom of expression in trademark cases, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. We have the constitutional right to freedom of expression in the United States and Germany and France. They also have a constitutional right to freedom of expression. And so sometimes when companies don't like someone complaining about them, they will file a trademark claim. And courts, usually when they hear the dispute, if the company can actually afford, who's accused of infringement can afford to litigate, courts will often rule in favor of the party exercising their free speech right. But the problem is a lot of times people can't afford to litigate in these kinds of cases. So usually the cases that you see being litigated involve a defendant who has a lot of money. So for example, Oprah Winfrey used the phrase, own your power. And somebody else had trademark rights in that phrase, and ultimately she prevailed, but she had to actually litigate the case all the way through summary judgment.
That's really fascinating. So a phrase like own your power, even if it's used, it sounds like in the Oprah case, which I'm not familiar with, it would have been in a different, first of all, not even in a commercial setting necessarily, right?
Well, in that case, she was using it in a manner that suggested perhaps she might herself try to commercialize it. She was having own your power conferences, things like that. That was one of the issues in the case, one of the reasons why it probably was not resolved on a motion to dismiss. But what concerns me more are the kinds of cases where you have maybe someone using expressions such as, for example, Donald Trump has registered Make America Great Again for a political action committee, but has used this registration, my understanding is used this registration to try to stop others from using this phrase on the front of clothing, T-shirts, hats, things like that. I think that's problematic because T-shirts can be just as expressive as a novel, as a film that is fully protected by the First Amendment.
So you mentioned this distinction between commercial use and non-commercial, or commercial speech and non-commercial speech. And we've talked about on the show before, and I'm sure you can help us understand better, that individuals receive more speech protection than corporate entities do. Is that shifting over time? And is there a distinction as you move country to country between how much protection a corporation might have for its speech?
That's a good question. Well, in some circuits in the United States, we do actually have a commercial use requirement. So, for example, somebody set up a website, bosleymedical.com, to complain about a company who did hair restoration. And the court in that case said that this was non-commercial speech, and so therefore there could be no infringement claim in that situation. Other courts do not actually say that commercial speech use in commercial speech is a requirement for an infringement cause of action. So an example would be the United We Stand case in the Second Circuit, where somebody, an organization was pretending to be United We Stand, Ross Perot's organization, and trying to raise money in connection by using that trademark. And the court said that infringement laws can apply to non-commercial speech. So in the past, you sometimes saw courts distinguishing between non-commercial speech and commercial speech. But courts do consider First Amendment interests or commercial expression to be protected in the context of comparative advertising. Descriptive fair use doctrine is another area where, again, we want to allow companies to use descriptive terms in good faith to describe their goods and services. We also see commercial parodies. So, for example, there was a company, Hot Diggity Dog, that sold Chewy Vuitton dog toys. Louis Vuitton sued them and claimed that this was infringing and diluting their trademarks. And ultimately, the court ruled in favor of Chewy Vuitton. Now, they had actually applied to register Chewy Vuitton as a trademark. So this is very, very much a commercial use of the mark. But the court said that because this was a parody of the Louis Vuitton name and marks and things like that, that this influenced the court's analysis of infringement and dilution, and ultimately the court ruled in favor of Hot Diggity Dog.
Well, that's good news. I'm glad to hear that I can still go out and obtain Chewy Vuitton dog toys and feel good about it. Not that I'm infringing anybody's mark.
Right. So you mentioned, what about other? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, you'd also asked about other countries too.
Yeah.
And so so the sale of T-shirts is considered more commercial, right, than putting somebody's trademark in the title of a film or in the content of a video game or something like that. And so in South Africa, for example, somebody was selling T-shirts that were basically poking fun of, or at least using a trademark, Carling Black label beer. And so it was Carling Black Labor was how they changed it. And they were commenting on various things relating to using, blacks, forced labor, things like that. And so in that situation, again, although this was a little bit more commercial, the court held that the sale of T-shirts with this changed logo was actually okay. It was protected expression under the Constitution in South Africa.
Yeah, that is fascinating. So we're going to see variation from country to country, how they're treating speech by individuals and commercial entities and how trademarks can be incorporated into that speech or not. I think all this gets really fascinating when you start to take social media into account, because it sort of deformalizes the speech that corporations would traditionally have either with each other or with the public. And one recent example of that has been the brand jacking that we saw back in September. I guess this is something that is happening more and more. I mean, I definitely see it on Twitter, and it really didn't occur to me how much it's happening until we lined you up for the show this week and I started paying more attention. But back in September, Facebook went down, and right away, various companies kind of piled on. Red Bull suggested that Facebook needed a pick-me-up with hashtag Facebook down. Coffee chains doing the same kind of thing. Marriott Resorts suggesting, with all the spare time, people unable to access Facebook, maybe this is a good time to think about vacation, that kind of thing. So it's certainly making use of another company's trademark for commercial purposes. But also, I mean, it's just kind of good fun. Companies just kind of razzing each other. What do you make of all this?
Well, the companies have been engaging in comparative advertising or poking fun at their competitors or other companies for a while, right? This happened way back when people started registering domain names. My understanding is that sometimes a company would register the domain name consisting of the trademark of its competitor, and the competitor would complain. And in that kind of situation, it could cause confusion. And so courts early on would say, look, if your domain name consists exactly of the mark of your competitor, we're going to require you to turn that over to your competitor. But there have been situations on social media, Facebook and Twitter, where companies will poke fun at the other side. So I think I recall on Twitter, I think Coca-Cola had said that Coke was the preferred soft drink in the White House instead of Pepsi. They used the word Pepsi in the tweet, right? But this is not a trademark use of the word Pepsi. It shouldn't be actionable trademark infringement, I think. One of the challenges, though, is if we have someone posting comments like this on Facebook or Twitter or other sites, if somebody does complain about this to the social media site, what do they do, right? In copyright law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act provides a safe harbor. If you have a notice and takedown regime where if someone complains and you take down the infringing or allegedly infringing post, the internet service provider is protected. And if the user complains about the takedown, they can actually put it back up again. It's called a counter notification, and the internet service provider is protected. In the trademark area, we don't have something that's similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that protects these third parties. And so this can be a problem for these companies because, they probably don't want to be involved in a lot of litigation anytime someone is accused of infringing trademarks on their site. So it's rational for them to take it down. But luckily, some of the sites are more speech protective. Twitter, for example, allows news sites and parody sites and fan sites, but you have to be very clear that this is not the trademark holder. So sites like Facebook and Twitter also, prohibit impersonation of trademark holders. Again, if you're pretending to be the trademark holder, it's not going to be okay. They're going to take it down. You might be liable for infringement of the trademarks, even if it's a non-commercial use. But if it's a commercial use and you're impersonating somebody, I think that's really going to open the door to an infringement suit.
Right. This is the kinds of situations, these brand hijacking kind of episodes are not a likelihood of confusion kind of scenario. It's more like a tarnishment or disparagement kind of scenario that they might be concerned with, right?
Right, exactly. So one example I use in a paper that I wrote, Brand Jacking on Social Networks, is somebody registered Nine West Shoes on Facebook for a Facebook page and solicited women to submit their contact information and photographs of their bodies and their toes according to the page that they would be entered to be in a contest to become a model for Nine West Shoes. Well, it turned out that this was a completely fake website. It was probably some sort of foot fetish person. And so Facebook complained and then tried to find out the identity of the person who'd set up the site. Not Facebook complained, but Nine West complained. Facebook took down the site, but then this person set up another fake Nine West Shoes page, and this one solicited girls to submit photos as young as 12. Situation, right, it's not a commercial use of Nine West Shoes trademark, but that's very harmful to Nine West Shoes, right? It tarnishes their mark and also could potentially harm the women and girls who submitted contact information hoping that they could become a model for Nine West Shoes.
Wow, how creepy. All right, we're going to take a break here on that note. Thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. We're going to get back into the show with Lisa Ramsey in just a moment here, talk more about potential intermediary liability for trademark infringement online. Before we do that, though, I hope you're hungry, because now would be a great time to bust out some of that Blue Apron that you might have coming to your house. And if you don't have it coming to your house, well, now would be a great time to go ahead and sign up and get some delivered. Blue Apron is one of the greatest things, I think, to have come into my and my family's life. We all love to cook, but none of us really have the time to get the fresh ingredients in the right proportions, to think about what recipe we want to make that night. You know, I mean, it really, if you're going to be a devoted, good cook, it takes a lot of your spare time. And there are people with the passion who can really devote the time to that. I'm not one of them, unfortunately. However, I do know my way around the kitchen a little and enjoy cooking. Blue Apron's great even for folks who don't have those basic cooking skills, because you're going to feel like a cook once you've made your way through a couple of these dinners. You're going to learn your way around the kitchen. Cooking at home, though, means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again and again. Blue Apron makes sure that for less than $10 a meal, you get all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals and easy step-by-step instructions to take you through, whether you're a master chef or someone who just is aspiring. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store, no more takeout. No matter what your dietary preferences are, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like harissa lamb and beef burgers with roasted carrot fries, or rice noodles and coconut matcha broth with delicate squash, bok choy, and Thai basil right in your own kitchen. And as you can gather from just those sample meals I mentioned, they are ranging the globe for their flavors and combinations. I'm constantly blown away by the fusion that they managed to bring into their recipes, and how great those flavors work together. We, in our household, love a little variety in our diet, love a little spice. Of course, when you're making it at home, you can control exactly how spicy you want to make something or how flavorful. You can cook with ingredients that you've never used before, such as watermelon radishes, farro, or purple potatoes. I don't know if you've used those before, but you may not have. And they're just examples of the kinds of unique ingredients that Blue Apron makes sure to incorporate into their recipes. And with all this flavor, you'd certainly assume that you were eating more than 500 to 700 calories per portion, but you'd be wrong. That's what the average portion is. They're delicious and good for you. So right now you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for helping me make my way around the kitchen in a more efficient manner, and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, getting back into trademark law and how those considerations play out in the world and online with Professor Lisa Ramsey from the University of San Diego School of Law. We've been discussing brand jacking a bit. I guess the example of Facebook going down is a little different than some of the case law out there. It doesn't have to do with someone misappropriating a domain name or even a subdomain name. I know that there was a lot of scrambling as social media sites really became popular to have the proper name after the forward slash, right? What's your Twitter handle going to be, or your easy to remember name on Facebook? It seems to me like as social media companies have just sort of taken trademark litigation over these issues out of play by adopting policies where if you can come to them and show, hey, we're the trademark holder here and someone else has it, they're squatting on our subdomain, will you please fork it over to us? It's not maybe the easiest process in the world, but they have processes in place to deal with that. Am I right?
That's correct. One of the things that I teach my trademark law students is that you have a variety of options if someone's using your trademark without authorization. You know, sure, you could send a cease and desist letter and file a complaint in federal or state court, but a less expensive option would be just to complain to Facebook or Twitter or Google. If it's a domain name registration, you can file a complaint with the World Intellectual Property Organization and try to get the domain name transferred to you or canceled. And so one of the benefits of these kinds of private dispute resolution procedures is that it's efficient, it's cheap. The downside is it's not transparent. We don't know if they're adequately protecting free speech interests. And so as a result, right, it's problematic if as a result, we need more laws to protect the Facebooks and Twitters of the world if they want to go ahead and leave up posts such as the ones that you were talking about, where, again, you said it was brandjacking. It's a different kind of brandjacking in the sense of using somebody else's trademark in a way that, again, it's not trying to cause confusion about the source or sponsorship of products, but you're just, you're just making a joke. You're it's a pun, those kinds of things. And I guess one of the things we need to be thinking about as, as citizens, as judges, as legislators, is do we want trademark owners to own basically, we have the right to control most uses of their trademarks in any kind of commercial or non-commercial, mostly commercial context. Are there some situations where we think it's okay for others to be able to use trademarks in parody or commentary, or just, again, to make a joke about the fact that Facebook's site is down? Obviously, my scholarship, I think that we should have that kind of marketplace of ideas and information. I think, a lot of these brands are worth millions of dollars, and they want to protect that goodwill, that reputation. I understand why they want to control these kinds of uses of their trademarks. But I think in a democratic society, it's better to be able to poke fun at the brands or to use the brands to make comments about the world in general.
Right. I mean, it seems like social media companies are maybe hiring very savvy staff to try and make these determinations. Is this, it takes a lot. I mean, it takes someone like a law professor who studies trademark law to figure out, is this something where we should protect the speech, or is this something that could get us in trouble? How do you think they're handling those situations?
Well, a lot of sites are actually doing things to protect competition and free speech. So, for example, Etsy and a couple of other companies recently sent a letter to the government asking them to try to set up maybe create some sort of law. I believe it was a law that would be similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but for trademarks. And so to give them a safe harbor if they decide to allow someone's post to remain up despite an allegation of trademark infringement. So that's one way we could do it, is have legislators actually pass a law protecting internet service providers who provide a forum for people to sell goods and services such as Etsy or resell such as eBay, or a forum for people to post about companies. One of the challenges too is a lot of companies don't like the fact people are complaining about them on Yelp and other sites, and have even sometimes filed defamation suits or trademark infringement suits against people who post negative consumer product reviews. And definitely there's a problem with fake reviews out there, but a lot of people can't afford to defend against a defamation or trademark suit on the basis of just a post, if they've just posted a negative review, it chills expression. And so so it'd be nice to have laws that protect consumers when they do things like this. Recently, some legislators have proposed that we have a federal anti-SLAPP bill. SLAPP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. This is referring to is a situation where somebody tries to file a suit against somebody to stifle or chill their expression by imposing this huge cost of litigation on them. And they hope that they'll just go ahead and stop speaking because they can't afford to fight. A number of states, such as California, have anti-SLAPP statutes. And so what happens if someone files a complaint against you, you can file a motion to dismiss and a motion to strike. Or I guess it's a motion to dismiss in the federal court. I believe it's called a demur in the state court. But regardless, you can file a motion to strike that this is a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And if you can establish that this is actually a suit that's trying to suppress chill expression, number one, and that the plaintiff's unlikely to succeed on its claims, the case can be dismissed before discovery, which again is very expensive. So we want to be able to dismiss those kinds of frivolous claims early in the litigation. So again, we can do this at the level of laws, both state and federal laws. And then the companies such as Facebook, Twitter, Etsy can set up a notice and takedown regime to protect trademark holders, but at the same time, hopefully set up a counter notification type of system allowing people to challenge this takedown request. And so hopefully what would happen is that it would, the material would be posted again and it would only be removed once a court orders it to be removed.
Right. So I'm a little confused. Are you saying that there are lawmakers proposing drafting laws that would be sort of a trademark parallel to Section 512 of the DMCA that would establish notice and takedown procedures? Or are you saying that companies are sort of instituting this themselves or both?
My understanding is that companies have asked people in the government to pass such a law. I am not aware if any legislators are currently doing that with regard to a trademark version of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. What I do know, though, is that some legislators are currently considering laws that would protect consumers who do negative product reviews,
right.
And so the federal anti-slap statute, and then I think that was raised in the House, and then in the Senate, my understanding is that in one of the committees that there was consideration of a bill that would protect consumers who review companies.
Yeah, I want to talk more about reviews and protection for consumers in a little later in the show. Right now, let's stick with this concept of not protecting the consumer, but maybe protecting the intermediary site. We had a case come out recently that involved the two major app stores. And actually, it doesn't look like it involved the iTunes store, but it involved the Amazon App Store and the Google Play Store concerning an app for whom the plaintiff owned a registered trademark of the name Free-Kickmaster. And they were doing movies and TV shows about sports with kicking. And then there were various other apps that were named Free-Kickmaster that were allegedly close to what the registered trademark holder was doing. And so... what the plaintiff wanted here was for these other apps to get kicked out of the app stores. But that's not what wound up happening. Have you looked at this case and can you tell us more about it?
Sure. I haven't read the opinion, but I did read a post about it. So you've explained the facts pretty well. So the issue here, right, is what do you do when someone has a trademark and a term that arguably is descriptive of the product, right? Here it's a game about people engaging in this free kick, kind of sport. One question would be if third parties are registering apps with the same name, are they free writing or are they actually just describing the content of the apps, the games that are in their apps? This issue's come up in the past with Candy Crush Saga. They got trademark rights in that word, but then they were also claiming that no company could use just the word candy as part of the name of their app. And a lot of people complained about that. So I think apps are just like any other kind of good and service in the sense that, you need to have a name to identify and distinguish your good or service, right, your app. But at the same time, if you have a weak trademark, one that's descriptive, perhaps it has secondary meaning, so it's protected. The problem is that you shouldn't have very strong trademark rights in descriptive terms like this. I've actually written an article arguing that we shouldn't protect trademark rights in descriptive terms because it's anti-competitive. Companies should be able to use descriptive terms, not just when they're talking about their products and advertising copy, but also as part of their brand names, in slogans and domain names. And so because you can get trademark rights in descriptive terms, companies not only get them, but also claim that they have trademark rights even when they don't have secondary meaning. In that case, I don't know. I think you mentioned that they had a registered trademark. After 5 years on the register, a mark can become incontestable, which means that nobody can challenge it on the ground that it's descriptive but does not have secondary meaning, right, or acquired distinctiveness. And so you still, as a plaintiff, have to show a likelihood of confusion. So if this company had sued in court, right, they'd have to show likelihood of confusion or dilution. But if they go to this third-party, intermediary, such as Apple or Amazon, or Android, then they ask for it to be taken down, but ask for these third-party apps to be taken down that have these descriptive words in them, the companies are in a tough position, because if they leave it up, they might be sued for secondary, right, or indirect liability for allowing these companies to remain up there. They may have people that review this dispute and decide that this is okay to post or not post it. But once somebody has a registered trademark or even a contestable trademark, and that's situation, right? This is a protectable trademark, right? And so they're supposed to take down, I think they would probably, it'd be best for them to take down those apps that have identical trademarks because of the fact that you have a presumption of validity if the mark's registered. They're in a tough spot. So they might believe that these terms are descriptive. They describe the video games and might want to leave these apps up there. But because of the fact that this other company has a registered trademark, they might want to take it down. But what's nice about this court's opinion is the court said that apparently in that case, the plaintiff had not actually requested that they take down these sites, hadn't taken advantage of a notice and takedown regime. Mm-hmm. And so the court said that they weren't liable. But the problem with that decision is that, in a sense, it suggests that had they actually requested that these third-party apps be taken down and the companies didn't take them down, then they might be liable. If we didn't protect descriptive terms, this wouldn't be a problem. People could use these terms. Perhaps they should use more distinctive words as part of their brand names. But again, we do protect descriptive terms. And so as a result, only one company can get rights to use these kinds of words in a brand name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this case seems to point up the need maybe for something in place under the law and not just left case by case to each third party intermediary's policymakers, whether there's a notice and takedown procedure in place or not. Because here, the balance of the case was controlled by the state law claims were controlled by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives a lot of protection to third party intermediaries to shield them from the liability of their users' actions, but intellectual property related claims are carved out of that. Unless there was this notice and takedown procedure in place, this would be a pretty wide open question. You know, in the absence of such a procedure, it seems like the court here said, well, there was a procedure in place, they didn't use it, so they're out of luck. And so we're going to go ahead and leave the apps up. But as you point out, if they had used it, then Google Play and Amazon could have been subjected to liability. There's nothing, under the law that would have shielded them there, right?
Well, so they would either, they probably would not be directly liable. So for indirect liability, you'd have to show inducement of infringement or material contribution to infringement, right? That you are continuing to provide your service to this party who's infringing someone's trademark you know or have reason to know that they're infringing the trademark. Also, you can't be willfully blind as to someone's infringement. So again, once they're put on notice of a claim of trademark infringement, the only way if they don't take it down, they could try to argue that this mark is not protected, right? It's not a valid trademark, or that there's no infringement, or that there's some sort of defense. But mm-hmm. if the underlying use is actually infringing, then the third party provider could be infringing under indirect trademark infringement liability as well.
Yeah, that seems a little scary. All right, let's move on. You had written at the beginning of the year, and I'm interested to see what happened, about a fight over who owned national park trademarks. There is a company who is a third-party contractor who has been running concessions in hotels in certain national parks, including Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, who acquired the trademarks to what they were running, things like Camp Curry and the Iwani Hotel, when they became that third-party concessionaire. Now they are demanding that whoever takes over their contract, I guess their term is up, this concessionaire is called Delaware North, And they're demanding tens of millions of dollars to use those names that it has trademarked, including Yosemite National Park. So litigation was ensuing earlier this year. I'm wondering if you can tell us if you've been following along, what's happened here, have the parties worked it out, or is it still embroiled in the courts?
Yes, that was the case. It was an issue back in January. I actually didn't write the article, but I was interviewed on that topic. So Delaware North was a concessionaire for Yosemite National Park and had applied to register the Ahwahnee, Curry Village, Badger Pass, Wawona Hotel for souvenirs and clothing. So one of the issues that came up, right, is whether or not the contract that they had with the National Park Service basically said that they owned the trade, that they would basically own the trademarks, or whether they're an exclusive licensee of the trademarks. And I actually have not seen the contracts between the two companies, between Delaware North and the government. So the challenge here, right, for the government is that, if the contract allowed them to actually get rights to the trademarks and register them, these kinds of trademarks are very valuable. And so they were valuing, I believe it was at $51 million that they said if they lost the concessionaire, the right to be the concessionaire, that then whoever took it over would have to pay $51 million. The government actually valued the trademarks at a lower amount, and basically said, well, whoever ends up getting the concession doesn't have to continue to use these trademarks, could change the names. But a lot of people complained about this and said that, if you're talking about Yosemite National Park, they have these trademarks have historical significance. They shouldn't have to change the names under trademark law. So I did a little bit of research before today, and it turns out that in September, Delaware North actually sued the federal government for breach of the contract that they had with the government regarding the concessions. They're seeking $10 million in damages because they didn't require the party who actually won the concession, Yosemite Resorts International, to purchase their intangible property, right, the trademarks. So I'm not sure what's happened since September, but according to this article that I looked at, there's actually a U.S. code that gives the National Park Service the right to retain historic names. It's section 302.106, notwithstanding the trademark, the fact that there might be trademark infringement. One other thing, too, my understanding is that the National Park Service has claimed that they have common law rights in these words. Although the marks were registered by Delaware North, they're claiming that they actually have priority. I don't know if they've applied to cancel any registrations or opposed any applications by Delaware North, but it looks like this dispute is ongoing between the two companies. So again, what's going to be important here is what does the contract between Delaware North say and the government, and what would a court find with regard to who has priority and ownership of the trademarks? If you have a registration, that's actually, you have a presumption of ownership of those marks. So the National Park Service would have to overcome that presumption.
Can it happen in trademark law? And do you think this is a kind of example where it can happen, where you can attack the validity of the trademark registration itself, somewhat like you can do in patent law? This is something that just never should have been registered as a trademark.
Oh, right. Yeah. So the way it works is that you apply for a trademark. If the trademark examiner says it's okay, then somebody can oppose it before it becomes registered. Once it becomes registered, within the first 5 years, you can petition to cancel the trademark on any number of grounds that are listed in the Lanham Act, right, the Federal Trademark Act. After 5 years, your grounds for cancellation become more limited. You can't cancel a mark, for example, on the basis that the mark is descriptive but doesn't have secondary meaning, or that the mark is likely to cause confusion with another mark that you own, for example. But you could still cancel the mark if it's become generic. So an example, right, is the word Murphy. Well, actually, that was not, I'm trying to think of a good example, but there have been a number of examples of marks that were previously very strong marks, a cellophane, escalator, which ultimately were no longer protected because they became generic terms. Also, certain kinds of product designs if they become functional. That's another reason you might cancel a registration. One challenge, though, is that for certain, if you actually apply to make your trademark contestable, something I mentioned earlier, which you can do after 5 years on the register, if you sue somebody for infringement, your trademark right is deemed it's valid and it's subject to a couple exceptions, right? Again, if it's generic, if the mark's been abandoned, if the trademark is functional. So here, you know, the challenge might be, you know, if and again, I don't know, you know, if the National Park Service is claiming they had common law rights that were superior to, you know, to the Delaware North, then, you know, we'd have to see what the court would think about that.
All right. Well, I think we're going to take a break here and thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. FreshBooks, if you're a freelancer or you run a small business, chances are your least favorite part of doing that is rummaging through receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I use FreshBooks in my law practice, and thank goodness I do, because otherwise I would have to have a staff, which would be very difficult for me as a sole practitioner, because getting the bills out at the end of the month is fairly labor intensive if you don't have FreshBooks. If you're not a numbers person, even if you are, FreshBooks just takes care of all of this professionally, slickly, quickly. You'll be creating and sending your invoices in just minutes. You can even now get paid up front. You can request a deposit in FreshBooks. No more covering costs out of pocket or waiting till the end of a project to get paid. You can organize your expenses easily. It's easy to track your time almost instantly, whether you're doing work at your desk or on the go. You can use your mobile device to capture your time. With their automated late payment reminders, you can avoid those awkward emails to late paying clients. And with FreshBooks automated customer reviews report, you can see all of your reviews in one place, then easily post them on your website. You'll wonder why you didn't start sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/Twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for supporting my law practice and for supporting this episode of This Week in Law. All right, we've been talking trademark and international law with Lisa Ramsey. We've touched on some free speech issues as they coincide with trademark law. I think we're going to get a little bit deeper into some recent free speech developments about now. Let's talk about unconstitutional prior restraints. This is a term that you might not have heard before if you haven't been to law school and you're not someone who pays attention to the kinds of things the ACLU does. But it's when the government tries to curtail someone's speech in order to curtail some other kind of action. And there is a case now that's just come down from the Seventh Circuit. Judge Posner wrote the decision, very interesting read, that had to do with a Cook County sheriff named Thomas Dart, who in previous years has been trying to police the more illicit parts of Craigslist. Now he is after a platform called Backpage, which has sort of, I guess, become the more go-to place for online prostitution. And Sheriff Thomas Dart wanted to take some steps that would prevent Backpage from being able to do business. So he sent sort of a saber-rattling letter out to Visa and MasterCard, threatening them with investigation and prosecution if they did not cease doing business with Backpage. He has been sort of back and forth in the courts on this issue. The Seventh Circuit has decisively determined, however, that this was not an okay thing for him to do. Can you tell us why, Lisa?
Well, part of the problem is that he was seemed to be acting in his capacity as a sheriff, right? If he just as a citizen had complained about the site, that would be one, or, you know, told Visa, MasterCard they shouldn't be working with a site like this, that would be one thing. But here, the letter that he wrote, he actually noted that he was sheriff, and he actually seemed to sign it in his official capacity. And so the court was concerned that here the government would be trying to stifle expression that perhaps, you know, would be okay. I think here, my understanding is that a lot of this would still be okay on the internet, by and trying to stifle it by discouraging companies like Visa and MasterCard from working with these companies that have this kind of content online.
Right. I guess one of the issues here is that much of what Backpage.com does is perfectly legal. Just having an adult site is not illegal. Of course, you know, if you are hosting or providing a platform for online prostitution, I assume there are ways that law enforcement can go after you for that. But there are other perfectly legal parts of their business that apparently this sheriff was seeking to interfere with by trying to make sure that Visa and MasterCard would not deal with them. So that is what the Seventh Circuit has taken issue with here. Were you surprised to see a county sheriff taking matters into his own hands like this, Lisa?
Well, I mean, I think some people feel very strongly that this kind of content should not be online, mm-hmm. but others obviously enjoy this kind of content. And so, again, I think that people should be able to express themselves and complain about sites like this if they disagree with them. But the problem here is that he seemed to be doing this in his official capacity. And so I think that's the concern of the court, is that you know, you can't just try to pressure companies not to allow certain kinds of expression on the internet. Again, if it was, like you said, if it was something against the law, it might be a different situation. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting, yeah, you talked about being a prior restraint of speech. I mean, often you hear this language in decisions where, you know, like the Pentagon Papers case, where the government doesn't want a news organization to publish something that would be of public interest because of national security concerns. Sometimes you might have a trademark owner who would file an infringement or dilution suit, and they want a preliminary injunction very early in the case to try to stop somebody from using a trademark. And those kinds of situations, right, this could arguably a prior restraint on speech, right? Because trademarks are, you know, they communicate, whether it's source communication about source or communication about ideas. So in the example of a consumer product review, if somebody files a request for a preliminary injunction and the court grants it, it would prevent you from using the trademark to talk about the company. And so I think that's why Eugene Volokh and Mark Lemley have written a paper where they talk about the fact that that a lot of these IP laws, you know, copyright, trademark, if the courts actually grant a preliminary injunction before a full hearing on the merits, there could be a First Amendment problem there because it would be a prior restraint on speech. Again, once it's found that the, you know, the expression is you know, obscene or is infringing, it's okay to enjoin that speech. But that's the challenge here, is when you're doing it before expression is actually published, or if you're trying to stop somebody from using intellectual property before there's a full hearing on the merits.
Got it. All right. Well, that was an interesting development from the Seventh Circuit. Over here in California, in the Ninth Circuit, we have a case that was decided recently where the U.S. Supreme Court has been invited to get involved and see if it was decided correctly. It's the Davis versus Electronic Arts case issued earlier this year, and it involves rights of publicities of sports figures who are incorporated into video games. We've talked about this case on the show before. I believe, Lisa, that you were a signatory on an amicus brief that was filed in the case.
That's correct. Eugene Volokh and Jennifer Rothman worked on an amicus brief, and a number of law professors, IP professors, but also constitutional law professors signed on. And we're asking the Supreme Court to take this case because we think that the law on how to balance First Amendment free speech interests against the right of publicity interests is very unclear. Because the right of publicity rate of publicity cause of action is a state law rather than a federal law, you have a lot of very different laws. And then in addition to that, you have a lot of different defenses that are based on freedom of expression. So you have a transformative use test. You have something called the Rogers balancing test. The transformative use test is something that was borrowed from copyright law. There's a case involving the song Pretty Woman. There's a rap group that did a parody of Pretty Woman that Roy Orbison and Atkoff Rose did not like, and so they sued. And the Supreme Court said that if you have transformed the original copyright work, that that this could be a fair use of the work. And this doctrine of transformatives was imported into the right of publicity law in the California in a case, Comedy versus Satirep, involving a charcoal drawing of the Three Stooges. And what the court said is that if you have transformed the celebrity's image, in that situation, free expression interests might trump right of publicity interests. In that case, the artist hadn't actually changed the image of the actor of the actors as much, so it was not considered to be a transformative use. But so that's one test. Other circuits apply, the Rogers balancing test, which is a test that's been applied in the trademark context. For example, in the Ninth Circuit, when Aqua came out with the song Barbie Girl, that poked fun at Barbie. The Ninth Circuit applied this test and basically asks, is this use of the trademark here Barbie artistically relevant? And because the song was about Barbie, the court said yes. And then the test asks whether this use explicitly misleads as to the source or content of the work. And in the Barbie Girl case, there was no evidence that the Aqua was trying to suggest that Mattel was connected to the song. So this Rogers test has been applied in some cases, right of publicity cases. One is the Parks versus the Face case, where a group, I forget the name of the music group, but they did, perhaps it was Outkast, they did a song that was entitled Rosa Parks, and it really had nothing to do with Rosa Parks, except there was one part of the lyrics that had a statement, everybody get to the back of the bus, or something to that effect. And they actually said that they weren't talking about Rosa Parks. So in that case, although the court applied the test, the court said that they actually didn't prevail under that test.
Right.
But regardless, there are a lot of different tests, and some circuits are more protective of free speech interests than others. And so what we're doing is asking the Supreme Court to make some sense of the law. And we're arguing that the court should try to be nice if they could be consistent and have a similar test for trademark and right of publicity law. Because a lot of these cases where you have a right of publicity claim, plaintiffs will also file a false endorsement claim under trademark law. So Section 43 of the Lanham Act, which is USC 1125A, allows a suit for infringement or false endorsement if your use of someone's trademark, and here the trademark would be the celebrity's name or their identity, this use suggests that the celebrity is affiliated with or sponsors, affiliated with the goods or sponsors the goods in some way. And so some people think that this test should apply both in the trademark context, but also the right of publicity context. But again, because, and so it's a problem if you have one test where it's okay to use it, for example, under trademark law, but then you have a more strict test that's very hard to win on for free speech purposes and right of publicity law, then the ultimate result is, right, you can't end up using the image in your expression.
Right. This is one I really hope the Supreme Court takes and gives us some guidance on, because it seems like a pretty murky area. It depends on the game, how they're going to use the name and or image and or likeness of a celebrity or a professional athlete. But, I think in some instances they may use the name. In other instances, they just create another a character that is sort of unmistakably that person. If you know what that person looks like, maybe the number is involved, etc. So there's all kinds of ways in which, you know, the game is capitalizing on that individual's fame without compensating them, and yet making some sort of transformation. You know, it's not a one-to-one identity of that person. It's not using a photograph or video of the person. So I think it gets really, really confusing and is a tough call. And it would be good to see the Supreme Court get involved. I mean, it would be good to see confirmation that video games are entitled to free speech protection. But there should be some line drawn into what constitutes free speech and what constitutes misappropriating somebody's identity, shouldn't there?
Yes. And so some courts have said that more commercial uses of a trademark, right? Obviously, we've talked about this before, or even of someone's celebrity's image or name would be less protected. So the Rogers balancing test in the trademark context was not applied to in commercial advertisements in one situation where it was an advertisement for a video game, I believe. So courts might make that distinction between commercial and non-commercial speech. You know, we just talked about false endorsement and right of publicity in my class yesterday. And we talked about, you know, like you mentioned, the interests that players would have, NCAA players, NFL players, both current and former, might have in being able to control the use of their identity, right? They want to control it. They might want to be compensated from it. You know, it's one thing if you've agreed by contract to let, you know, the NFL or the NCAA, you know, use your image. But if, you know, for a lot of these players, they didn't have contract provisions on point. And so they're saying, hey, we, you know, we should be compensated or we should be able to control whether our image is used. So that's one argument. But on the other side, right, is the argument that, you know, as a society, we'd like to be able to, you know, talk about companies, right, use their trademarks or use the names or images of celebrities and stories that we've made up. Or if we're doing a realistic account of something that happened in history, we want to be able to depict those individuals. And so in the brief, they mentioned, you know, the movie Selma, Forrest Gump, Midnight in Paris, a number of other films, right, or novels, for example, where real people are depicted. And so one of the issues mm-hmm. in this case that's on appeal to the Supreme Court is that, you know, in a situation where you're trying to depict real events, you actually don't want to transform the celebrities, you know, or the individual's, mm-hmm. you know, image because you want to depict them realistically. And so so the First Amendment should protect the realistic or accurate depiction of somebody in addition to protecting a transformative use of their image or other aspects of their identity.
I could see where that's the case in Selma or Forrest Gump or Midnight in Paris, but do you think that a video game is a similar situation?
Well, so the Supreme Court in Brown recently held that video games are entitled to full First Amendment protection, just like films mm-hmm. and novels and paintings. And so at least the Supreme Court says we should treat them the same. I understand that some people would think that video games should be different. They're a little bit more commercial. You know, again, there's this, what I always tell to my students, you know, the one end you have political speech, right? Very clearly non-commercial. At the other, you have, you know, an advertisement for a can of peas, right? And in the middle, you have, right, you have a number of things that are expressive, right? You have songs and films that are sold for profit. You have t-shirts, right, and posters and other kinds of expressive merchandise. And you have video games. And I think some people used to consider those to be more kind of in the middle. But now after the Brown case, the court has suggested that video games should be as protected as films and novels and things like that. And so if that's the case, right, that's current law, you know, one of the things that's argued in the brief is that if you can't use these celebrities' images in a video game, then that would then apply in the context of movies and novels and things like that. And so I think as a society, right, we have to decide, do we want a world where you can't either use someone's image, name, or likeness without getting their consent, because they might say no. You know, and there's a case involving Vanna White. I don't know if you've heard of this case. Samsung a while back put out this ad campaign where they talked about all these things that might be going on in the future, and their products would still be there, like their VCRs would still be used. Of course, we're not using VCRs right now, but and so they had a robot that was dressed like Vanna White in the sense that it had a dress similar to what she wore, a wig, a yellow wig. She was standing next to what looked like the Wheel of Fortune game board. And she sued for false endorsement and also right of publicity violations. Under the California statute, she couldn't prevail because they didn't actually use her image, right? But she could actually sue under the California common law because of the fact that people have clearly associated this robot with her. And so Judge Kaczynski in the Ninth Circuit wrote an opinion that was, I think it was in response to a denial of a rehearing en banc for the case, where he said that if we give celebrities, the exclusive right to evoke themselves, right, that society is going to be worse off. It's going to harm freedom of expression. He suggests that this should be left in the public domain and that people should be able to talk about celebrities, to poke fun at them, to use them in certain contexts. And I think the fact that this was a commercial, perhaps swayed the majority that Vanna White should be able to stop the use of her image. But again, I think, it's challenging to know where to fit the right balance. It'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does in this case and whether it treats trademarks and right of publicity claims the same or decides that there should be a different analysis.
Right. And so far, we don't know if it's going to the Supreme Court or not, right? We haven't heard from them on that front.
I've not heard anything so far.
All right. So one to keep an eye on. Let's get back to, before we wrap up our discussion of free speech related issues, the federal anti-SLAPP law that you raised, which is being called the Speak Free Act. This is pending in the House. It is the EFF and others are big fans of it. And as you mentioned earlier, it would give procedural protections. It would give defendants a way to fight lawsuits that they think have an ulterior free speech quelling motive. California, we know, has a statute like this. Other states do as well, but it is not universal in the United States. Do you think that having one at the federal level will be helpful?
Well, so the benefits, right, would be that that it would prevent people from forum shopping and filing a complaint in a jurisdiction that does not have an anti-SLAPP statute at the state level. And so the way that this proposed bill would work would be it would actually enable you to, if you're sued for defamation or maybe a trademark violation in state court, the lawsuit's trying to prevent you from expressing yourself on a matter of public concern, you can actually remove the case to federal court, and then the federal court could strike the complaint under the federal anti-SLAPP law. Some people have criticized this. My understanding is that the federal judges might not like this because then it means that they would get a lot more cases that are removed from state court to federal court. Again, if you're someone who thinks that we should be protecting free speech interests and in these kinds of cases, a federal anti-SLAPP statute is a good thing. Benefits of this, right, is not only could you strike the complaint, but you could actually get attorney's fees. And perhaps I think in some situations, I don't know if this is in the federal law, but I think in some state anti-SLAPP laws, you can actually get maybe damages if money for if you've paid experts to actually provide you with an opinion that you used as part of the litigation. So I think that it's a great idea to have a federal anti-SLAPP bill. We'll see what happens. My understanding is it's in the House. I don't know if it's going to go to the Senate. I think I mentioned before, the Senate was looking at it. It was the Consumer Review Freedom Act, and that's one that so this is interesting. This prevents businesses from actually contractually restricting customers from complaining about them because a number of people have, when you go, maybe you go to a doctor, or go maybe to a hotel or something, and if you actually sign some sort of contract saying that you won't complain about them, and then you do, right, argue they could sue you for breach of contract. And so so it'll be interesting to see what happens. My understanding is it passed in the committee and they're going to send it to the Senate.
Great. It's good to see our lawmakers paying attention to these sorts of issues. We have, to round out the show here, we have some privacy-related stories involving kids that I don't want to get into in too much detail, but just sort of highlight for you all that this stuff is going on. So let's address them real quick. All right. Well, the other shoe is dropping on a couple of fronts. Technologies that have been out there for a while, gathering data about children in particular, which of course is even more sensitive than the data about all the rest of us. Here we had, there's a good piece by Carl Bode over at TechDirt, who writes up what happened with VTech, who got hacked. The good news is here I don't know actually if I can find any good news in this story. Internet of Things is creeping into, of course, not just our kitchen appliances, but our children's toys. And in order to make them more and more interactive, companies are having them gather more and more data about the children that are using them. Here, the hacker obtained the names, email addresses, passwords, and home addresses of close to 5 million parents and the first names, genders, and birthdays of more than 200,000 kids. And the hack revealed that VTech was storing kids' selfies, voice recordings, and even entire chat logs between parents and their children. So I guess the moral here is for companies, if you're going to be gathering children's data, you know, we have laws in place in the United States. COPPA is very difficult to comply with, but apparently was no real hindrance to gathering all of this data on the part of VTech. But once you've gathered it, one of the things that COPPA does want you to do is keep it very secure. And apparently that wasn't the case here. As a hacker was able to get in and get all this information. And then similarly, you would think that Google would want to make sure that its apps for education are as safe and secure as possible. But the EFF has actually filed a complaint with the FTC that says that Google is engaged in a couple of no-nos with regard to its apps for education. There are a couple of things turned on by default that enable Google to gather information that technically is not for educational purposes, but for the purposes of helping Google be a more effective business. So the EFF is looking out on that front. That's something Google Apps for Education have been around for several years now. So and of course, toys have been gathering information about kids for lots of years too. So I think people are just now starting to feel the effects of that and take note that, gee, maybe we should be paying attention and make sure that this data is secure and is only being used in ways that parents affirmatively have consented to and not opted out of. Lisa, any thoughts on this?
Well, yes. So what seems interesting to me, because I know for myself even, I get worried about the fact that I'm being tracked whatever I do online. And so to think that my kids might be tracked is even more troublesome. But just requiring consent seems to me not to fix the whole issue, right? Because often people will just click that contract at the very end, you agree to these terms. And so a lot of times people don't read those. I don't either, even though I know I probably should as a lawyer. And people agree to things like this all the time. I have a colleague who's writing an article suggesting that in some terms and conditions of websites, right, you actually agree that the company owns particular trademarks. And she says, well, what if they start to say that you're agreeing the trademarks are distinctive and famous, which would mean that, you know, perhaps if you're sued for infringement, you you can't contest, you know, the fact that the marks are distinctive and famous. And so, you know, people agree to, it's Leah Chan Grinvold who's written this paper. So people all the time, right, click these contract terms, you know, just say, yes, sure. And so I think that in addition to making sure that parents understand what's going on, it's not just about, you know, having them agree to it. I think that we need to, again, kind of make sure that these companies are doing what they can to protect their systems from being hacked, but also making sure that they, not just require us to click the box, but really emphasize what it is that they're doing with our information, whether it's our kids or us.
Right. That's one of the things that COPPA tries to address. It tries to get around that, we're all just clicking the box and no one's paying attention to issue by really changing the playing field for getting consent from parents, that they actually won't allow you to tick a box and give consent that way, that there has to be an actual, in some cases, actually like a hard copy letter delivered back to the company will work. Telephone call to a customer service person will work. But that whole tick a box thing is sort of taken off the table, I think, because legislators realized, hey, you know, people aren't paying attention to that. And we want to make sure that the consent being given here is meaningful. But all that seems to do is leave us in a world where people avoid COPPA like the plague and don't allow folks under 13 to use their service. Or if they are allowing folks under 13 to use their service, maybe they're not, strictly speaking, as in compliance with COPPA as they should be. So it's not a perfect system by any means. And then in the Google example, where it's for education, I know there are provisions under COPPA that do sort of make it easier and less onerous to get consent. And once again, we're back in your problematic area, Lisa, where if the school is gathering the consent from parents, then, you know, if the school comes to you and presents you with something, then you're going to think it's okay, with maybe not without reading all the fine print, because of course it's the school and they have your child's and students' best interests at heart. So I think using schools as an intermediary and letting them get consent that way is somewhat problematic too, but COPPA does permit that. So just wanted to flag those issues for folks and make sure that you're paying attention to what sort of data is being gathered about your children. We're going to thank our third sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. We talked about getting yourself paid if you have a small business. Now with Braintree, we're going to talk about making sure that your customers have the best way to pay possible. Braintree is code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use this same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree will support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, consumer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, we're going to give you our tip and resource of the week and go ahead and get out of here. Our tip, I'm hoping, Lisa, you'll want to weigh in on too, and that is this case involving the gentleman who received a national security letter. I don't know if it's one of the first national security letters, but at this point, it is 11 years down the road since it was issued. His name is Nicholas Merrill. He had a company that provided internet access, I think, to some of his customers. He got a national security letter, and of course, then was subject to all of the gag order effect of it, and has been, even though the ACLU got involved and challenged the particular letter he received and the constitutionality of its legal basis, and actually got several concessions over the years from the court, narrowing down just what national security letters can do and how long they can gag people. But this particular guy, Nicholas Merrill, has been under gag order until November 30th of this year. Now he can finally talk about the national security letter he received, what he was asked for, et cetera, et cetera. So 11 years down the road, here we go. So our tip out of all of this is still to, you know, take those things seriously. It might be 11 years until you can talk about them, even though the Obama administration has now given some guidance to the FBI. And we're now looking at shorter time frames, either 3 years after the opening of a investigation or 3 years after the investigations close. So Lisa, you want to weigh in on national security letters and sort of the state of things now?
I think you've covered it, but thanks for asking.
All right. So everyone, if you'd like to look for more from Mr. Merrill, because now he can talk. Another thing, our resource of the week is somewhat local to the Bay Area, but I bring it up because it's a very cool idea, and it's something that maybe we'll be seeing in more neighborhoods as well. It is called the Bayview Hunters Point Community Legal Center. It was a winner of this year's Google Impact Challenge, which awarded over $5.5 million dollars to Bay Area nonprofits. It was one of the top 10 winners, so it received a $500,000 grant. And it touts itself as its neighborhood's general counsel. I think what Bayview Hunters Point hit on here is that legal aid is available in many forms. It tends to help people with their criminal law needs, or maybe more dire kinds of situations, but civil situations can be dire too. And that's what Bayview Hunters Point is providing, helping people respond to civil lawsuits when they don't have the resources to do so. So things like eviction, things like family law, et cetera, things that might not ordinarily be the subject of all kinds of legal aid alternatives. That's what Hunters Point is providing. And I love the notion that they are touting themselves as sort of the neighborhood's general counsel, sort of helping people not fall through the cracks and get caught in the legal system. So check out Bayview Hunters Point Community Legal. And congratulations to them on winning, being one of the 10 winners in the Bay Area of the Google Impact Challenge. Lisa, we need a second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. I guess maybe we'll make it 11 years on since Mr. Merrill can now talk about his national security letter experience. And Lisa, it's been so great chatting with you today. So many interesting areas of scholarship you're involved in. It's been great going deep with you on those issues today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
We really appreciate your time, and we appreciate the time of everyone who has joined us today. If you have done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC, that means you've joined us live. We're very glad that you were able to do that. If you could, if you are one of our live audience members on any given Friday, you can jump into our IRC chat and interact with us during the show. We love it if you can do that. But don't worry if you can't. If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, you'll find our entire archive of shows going back to the very beginning of This Week in Law. And if you're a YouTube person, you can find our channel there. We have various ways that you can enjoy the show on your own time. If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, all of them will be laid out there for you at your convenience. What else should you do? You should get in touch with us between the shows. You should email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv, or Sarah. She is Sarah P at twit.tv, to let us know what's on your mind, who you think we should invite on the show, any follow-up you have about topics we've discussed, things that you think we need to have on our radar. We really enjoy hearing from you. You can also find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Google+. To let us know how we're doing and what you would like to see more of on This Week in Law. Until next time, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this one up. I'd like you to take care, and we'll see you next week.